The Fair Housing Act is now 50 years old. This hour, why working against discrimination in housing is still relevant in 2018. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also, in this hour's quick conversations, the latest from the State House in an overtime session, a measles scare comes to Iowa. We'll hear from Democratic candidates for governor Nate Bolton and Fred Hubble, and Dad Decorah, the longtime patriarch from the famous Decorah Bald Eagle's Nest, goes missing. Buckle up for your NewsBuzz. News from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later this hour, we'll look at the Fair Housing Act. It's 50 years old as of April. We'll talk about why working against discrimination in housing, that's what the Fair Housing Act of 1968 is all about, is still relevant 50 years later in 2018. Also, we'll hear from Democratic candidates for Governor Nate Bolton and Fred Hubble. And Dad Decorah, did you hear the news? The longtime patriarch of the famous Decorah Bald Eagle's Nest has gone missing. I think this is day eight. We'll get an update on that. First of all, let's get an update on the legislature with IPR's Joyce Russell, our State House correspondent. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
So now, what, second week of overtime could set a new record going beyond a scheduled adjournment for when one party controls the House and the Senate and the governor's office. What's causing the overtime?
Oh, well, it's continued ongoing negotiations among Republicans over their tax cut package and also overall targets for the budget. Mm-hmm. I ran into a Senate leader this morning, Senator Jack Whitaker, said they're putting the finishing touches on their tax plan, but we've kind of heard promises like that before. So we're just waiting until they come up with an agreement.
Mm-hmm. And Democrats piping up that this is costing us taxpayers money, right?
Well, there is a certain cost involved in delaying the session. Most people, when they hear our reports, they've heard that when the official end of the session comes or the scheduled last day, that's when lawmakers' expense accounts run out. So they're not paid for meals and lodging after that day. But it still costs some money to keep things going around here. The estimate is about $10,000 a day. Lawmakers do get paid one round trip back and forth from home per week, as long as they're in session. And then there are printing costs, and then a lot of part-time, you know, some people work here full-time, so they're getting paid regardless. And you know, and legislators are paid a salary. Mm-hmm. But then there are some part-time session-only staff, and so they continue to have to be paid as long as they're in session.
Mm-hmm. Some news on medical marijuana here in Iowa at the tail end of this session. What's that?
Well, you know, the law that they passed last year clearing the way for medical marijuana had some significant restrictions on it, restrictions on the amount of the active ingredient in marijuana, capping the THC at 2%. And then other restrictions as well, restrictions on the conditions that can be treated with medical marijuana. And all along, the Iowa Senate last year, when they were, or rather 2 years ago, when they were controlled by Democrats, and then still last year, as they were controlled by Republicans, just wanted to go further. And so a bill to make it go further is advancing in the Iowa Senate. It's almost certainly not going to be considered by the House. The position in the House is that the only way they essentially, it might be overstating it a little bit, but essentially the only way they got this passed at all last year was to have these restrictions on it. But, you know, advocates for a much more liberal medical marijuana law still having their say in the Iowa Senate.
Okay. In just a few words, Joyce, before we say goodbye, your best guess on when adjournment will take place? Do you know? Okay.
I don't know.
You're sick of the question.
No, I'm not sick of the question. It doesn't look to me like they're going to finish this week. But, you know, sometimes things will click into place and then they do wrap things up.
Okay. We'll make sure we pay attention to your reporting from the State House, Iowa Public Radio's Joyce Russell. Thanks, Joyce.
Okay. Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, of course, the 2018 Iowa legislative session concluding in a matter of days. I sure hope you had a chance to check out IPR's new podcast on legislative issues, Under the Golden Dome. I'm joined now by the host of that program, John Pemble. Hi, John.
Hello, Ben.
Hey, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this program, especially to encourage those who haven't yet checked out this wonderful new podcast on IPR, to have you give it a sense of how you go about making it. But first of all, since we just talked with Joyce, from your perspective, what have you taken in as highlights since going back to the beginning of the session in January?
Well, you've certainly heard the big button issues, abortion, death penalty, taxes, budget. But we've also been talking about opioids. And there's a great conversation about the other kind of an opioid that we don't often acknowledge as a problem, that is heroin. It's very similar to the prescription stuff. How do we deal with people that are using this drug illegally, shooting up heroin? And we had an episode from February called Managing Opioids, where a person who is who's in recovery, he stopped using 5 years ago, talks to us about the need for a needle exchange program and how it helps people potentially get off of heroin. And as he's talking to us, he tells us that he has tested for hepatitis C and tells me after the interview that he hasn't told very many people about it. And he felt comfortable talking to us about this because he felt it was important to share his story about drug use and for people to better understand heroin and opioids abuse in a way that many people may not know.
Mm-hmm. And I think you go for sort of things that are happening that are out of the ordinary. I wonder if you could give us an example of where you had a scene, you recorded, and you said, that is a perfect fit for Under the Golden Dome.
Yeah, this was from February. Here's a two-minute clip, and this is an example, a rare example, of when I can tie stories together because of something that's happening in the building that's unusual. In February, the governor was giving her weekly press conference, and at the same time, there was a public hearing upstairs for a de-appropriations bill. And when you hear this clip, you're going to hear why I like this transition. You'll know it immediately. A little bit of a setup here. This happened a few days after there was a shooting at a Florida high school that killed 17 people. The governor opens a press conference by saying her thoughts and prayers are with the victims. Later, when members of the press ask her questions, they ask the governor what kind of gun legislation she would support. Should there be further gun control laws in Iowa? And then this is where we're going to come to her response to a question as to whether or not she supports a bill that at the time was in the Senate that would allow a person like a parent to carry a firearm with them when transporting their child to school.
What I think is great about the process is this is an opportunity in light of some of the things that have happened to take a piece of legislation like that, to have a committee, a subcommittee, a committee hearing to bring all interested parties together and to talk about the pros and cons and why it may work and why it may not work. But that's part of the process, and I'm sure you'll see more people engaged in that conversation. But, you know, I think we need to let the process do its place. And so from that perspective, that means anything that comes up, I'm not, you know, it we'll see where it ends up.
Ultimately, you'll have the final say.
Well, but I've said to you about 101 times, it just doesn't do me any good to speculate on bills until I see what that, there's all kinds of criteria that could be involved in that, different nuances. So I'll wait and see what it looks like in its final form and continue to encourage all stakeholders to come together as we have a conversation about protecting.
Another proposal is to arm teachers and school personnel. Is that a concept you would like to pursue?
I'm willing to have a conversation about all of those. But
the press conference is abruptly cut short by the Capitol's alarm system. For policy, the administration evacuates the building. Turns out it's a false alarm.
The press conference isn't the only thing interrupted. Upstairs, there is a public hearing about removing funding from this year's budget, as a University of Iowa student testifies against cutting higher education.
The state student loan default rate on students 3 years after graduation was 17.3%, which is the highest in the county, or the country.
If you can pause for just one moment while we get a better sense of what's happening.
The House is hearing testimony for a deappropriations bill. The deappropriation is where some of the money previously allocated to a department is going to be taken away. This hearing is about a House bill that will reduce some department budgets for this fiscal year.
That's a clip from Under the Golden Dome. John Pemble with me at the moment, the host of that Iowa Public Radio podcast. A great example there of action. You get a sense of really being
there. You can't
there.
Write things like that. I mean, right. It just happens. And they were both stories that I wanted to do a segment on. I'm like, well, here's an easy radio transition. And you needed those 2 minutes, though, to hear the intensity with which the governor is speaking, how she's being questioned by the press, and how some could say, well, she was saved by the bell, because they're about to lean in a lot more on that question, which, of course, she can handle. That's her job.
Mm-hmm. Now, the legislative session is about done. So what are the plans for Under the Golden Dome?
We're going to do only one more show, and we're going to wait until they adjourn. I don't like to speculate a great deal about Iowa politics, but the speculation coming from leaders at the Capitol is adjournment is more likely to happen in the first part of May. And that's when I suspect my show will be about taxes and budgets and the wrapping up of the 87th General Assembly.
Okay, John Pemble, host of Iowa Public Radio's Under the Golden Dome podcast. Find out more about it at iowapublicradio.org. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we're airing conversations with Iowa's gubernatorial candidates ahead of the June primary in the Democratic Party. Now let's listen to a conversation with Nate Bolden, an attorney, a Democratic senator from Des Moines. IPR's Clay Masters met with Senator Bolden in his Des Moines campaign office this past Wednesday, started off by asking him why he's running for governor.
Unfortunately, this past year and past legislative session, we've seen an agenda that has gone in the wrong direction, and it really struck me the end of the last legislative session when I was actually taking a look at this race to decide whether I was going to get in or not. I sat at my desk in the Iowa Senate and saw the yes-no buttons, and I just kind of said to myself, if I'm here in 2019 pressing that no button against an agenda that I disagree with and I think is harming Iowa's future, I'm not going to live with myself if I haven't done everything I possibly can to see us actually execute a plan for Iowa's future. And that really was when it really hit me that I was going to do everything I can to win this race for governor.
When you look at 2016, the last election, it was a very divisive election, the way that the campaigns played out. And there were a lot of people in Iowa who felt that the message from the current president, Donald Trump, spoke to them because they felt isolated. They felt like they'd been forgotten. Working class, blue collar, you saw it in many of these counties that went Republican for the first time in a long time. How do you think those people are going to hear your message when so much of politics is so divisive?
Well, I think it's got to be paired, the two things together, right? Our frustrations, but also our hope and our vision for the future. And I think that's the lesson that comes out of 2016, is that going forward, yes, we need to recognize that people do see certain things in their communities, in their lives, that need to be respected as very real concerns that should be discussed. But it's not just pointing out the negative. It's also sharing the positive. And that's, I think, the thing that our campaign has focused on the most, is pointing out the things that have been done this last 2 years in the legislative process that have held back and taken away from a quality of life of working Iowans that we want to see protected and promoted. We want the next generation of skilled workers to choose to stay in or come to this state, one of our biggest threats for the long-term future. We have to offer what they should come here to enjoy. And if we're deteriorating the quality of our schools, if we are struggling to provide health care, including mental health care, to Iowans, if we're not offering wage growth and an increase in some of the benefits that workers are searching nationwide to find, things like my paid family leave bill, we're missing that opportunity.
We've seen the revenue estimating conference regularly change how much money is coming into the state. What kind of sign and what kind of signal does that show you as to what kind of work would need to be done with the state budget?
Well, I'm on the Appropriations Committee in the Senate, so I think about the budget quite a bit. In fact, we're at a point right now where we should have a budget set and known for this next year, but we don't. In fact, we have had end-of-the-year budget cuts thrust upon places like the University of Iowa, Iowa State, and our community colleges without any idea how in the next 90 days they're going to have the ability to fulfill the next year's obligations. So this budgeting process is a disaster. And it's fiscal irresponsibility that's got us to this point. I mean, we are now spending the equivalent of $600 million a year in tax exemptions, credits, giveaways to corporations that are making it harder and harder to forecast the budget, that are making it harder for us to make ends meet. We are at a 17-year low in unemployment. There is no excuse for this state to go through mid-year budget cuts, to raid emergency funds and do emergency fund transfers, to make permanent budget cuts in these budgets when we should have the sun shining and the economy growing. I mean, when revenues are up year to year, we should not be going through these reckless cuts that are compromising critical things that a lot of times are revenue generating and positive impacts in our community. I mean, the proposal that we've seen come out this week, $100 million in tax cuts that are going to benefit by 80% the wealthiest 5% of Iowans, that's the last thing we need to be doing in this state. We have to be taking care of our education system. We have to be improving access to health care. We have to have real economic development for the long term. Those things aren't going to happen if we continue to drive ourselves down to a low-wage, low-skill state economy based on transactional, what I call corporate coupon economics, where we're going to give you something if you come in here for a set period of time and then allow that employer to go shake down the next state when that transactional period is over.
Water quality is something that we see pretty much becoming more and more of an important issue in the state every year. There was a bill, the governor said that she wanted it to be the first bill that she signed, and it was the first bill that she signed. It allocates more money for water quality projects to be done in the state to clean up Iowa's rivers, lakes, and streams. Does it go far enough?
No, it doesn't. And my frustration with this water quality bill is we heard in the condition of the state address, Governor Reynolds said she was going to push through a monumental water quality bill. Well, we're still waiting for the monumental water quality bill. What we got were the leftovers from last session that were not advanced because they didn't do enough. This is actually a very expensive way to do very little for water quality in this state. It doesn't have monitoring. It doesn't have a watershed approach. I've introduced legislation that actually gets us to where we should be in terms of doing the thing that voters asked us in 2010 to do. With over 60% of the vote, voters said, here's the solution we want. We want real, meaningful action on this. We want an Iowa Water Land Legacy Trust Fund with a dedicated revenue stream to deal with water quality and land management. And that wasn't urban versus rural. You look at where the votes came in on that. Iowans said, this is a priority. We want it funded. And it's something that offers a sustainable approach. When we talk about threats to agriculture in our future, you know, topsoil runoff is one of those top of mind threats because it's not just nitrates that are going into our waterways. It's not just, you know, the pollutants that we're worried about. It's the topsoil itself that's going down the Mississippi River. So we have to worry about the future of agriculture. It's the quality of life in terms of rural Iowans, in terms of hunting and fishing. Think of the economic development that can happen if we really did have a monumental approach to water quality and land management in this state. I'm proud to have introduced legislation to actually fund the Water Land Legacy Trust Fund, and I think we can get to a real solution that way.
Democratic State Senator Nate Bolton, who's running for his party's nomination for governor. You can find this interview and other gubernatorial candidate interviews at iowapublicradio.org. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, if you think measles is no big deal, I mean, when you stack it up against other communicable diseases, maybe it doesn't sound like much compared to malaria, pneumonia, HIV, AIDS. Then maybe it's a disease you don't have to worry about. Well, think again. Measles is a disease that affects about 20 million people a year in the world, primarily, though, in developing areas, Africa and Asia. It is a killer, though. In fact, no other vaccine-preventable disease causes as many deaths. And this month, two restaurants in Des Moines, the Des Moines metro area, were visited by a confirmed measles patient from Missouri, potentially infecting Iowans with this highly contagious disease. Kim Norvell is with us, growth and development reporter for the Des Moines Register. Hi, Kim. You've taken this up and looked into the answers to some very important questions surrounding measles, right?
Hi, yes, I have this week.
What can you tell us, first of all, about the exposure in the Des Moines area?
So this patient from Missouri visited two restaurants here in Des Moines. It sounds like he was traveling through the area and stopped at a Hardee's in Des Moines and then a Panera Bread in Ankeny and spent a couple hours there at each restaurant.
Mm-hmm. And so if you went to these restaurants during these times, you need to be on the lookout for symptoms. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Anyone who is at those same locations and has symptoms of measles needs to contact their doctor right away. Basically, their advice to stay home, don't run any errands or do anything like that, but set up a time to meet safely with your doctor to see if you are confirmed case as well.
Right, and this is so contagious, you shouldn't run to the doctor's office and sit in a waiting room, possibly infecting other people. Give us quickly the symptoms.
The symptoms are high fever, cough, runny nose, watery eyes, and then there's this telltale red rash that starts on your face and moves to the rest of your body. It's really itchy, and those symptoms can last for about 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Now, there is a vaccine against measles, but not everyone's vaccinated.
Correct. About 5% of Iowa school children aren't vaccinated under medical or religious exemptions. A large majority of those, about 7,500 students, claim a religious exemption. And under Iowa law, parents just have to sign a waiver saying immunization conflicts with a genuine and sincere religious belief, though experts say no major religion teaches that vaccines are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Others are medically exempt. If they have cancer or they're too young, under 12 months can't be mm-hmm. vaccinated.
Especially for certain age groups, this is a very serious disease, can result in death, but other consequences as well, right?
Yeah, there can be hearing loss. There can be other symptoms that just cause lingering problems. You can develop what's called, you know, I'm not going to butcher the name, but there's a rare fatal disease of the central nervous system that you can develop up to 10 years after having measles. You could get ear infections and diarrhea. Those ear infections can result in permanent hearing loss, and you can have pneumonia or swelling of the brain.
Mm. Okay, we've got about 30 seconds left. You talked with someone who had the measles back in 1977. Quickly, what does she remember most? Beth Lyon, her name.
Beth Lyon, yeah, she's 58 and had it in 1977. She said it sticks out really vividly in her mind still because it was so terrible. She had a fever of 104 degrees, a sore throat and cough. She developed that full body rash and was sick for about 3 weeks. And she had to stay home. There's a fear that people with measles would go blind or deaf if exposed to harsh light or loud noises. So she couldn't watch TV. She couldn't read. She had to keep the shades drawn the whole time, that whole 3 weeks that she was sick.
Okay, quickly, where can people turn to find out more information? Kim?
Go to the Iowa Department of Public Health website or the CDC. There's tons of information about the disease.
Kim Norvell, thanks for your reporting and this conversation. Growth and development reporter for the Des Moines Register. Thanks, Kim. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for having me. You too.
Coming up after a short break, we'll hear from another Democratic candidate for governor, Fred Hubble. Also learn about Dad Decora. This is the longtime patriarch from the famous Decora Bald Eagle's Nest. Has gone missing. We'll get an update when we come back from John Howe of the Raptor Resource Project. A few other things you'll want to stay tuned. Oh, yes, 50 years since the Fair Housing Act was signed into law. We'll remember that. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
So glad to have you with us midstream on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Lots more to come this half hour. Let's start off with this. The father of the famous Decora Bald Eagle's Nest has been missing. It's been something like a week. On Monday, an active search ended. At last check, I think, still no sign of the eagle known as Dad Decora. A lot of people paying attention. 400 million online viewers. John Howe is with us, joining us live with an update. Executive Director of the Raptor Resource Project. Hi, John.
Hi, Ben.
Dad Decora still missing?
Yeah, we still have no positive sightings or recovery information, and we are still getting reports of large raptors or you know, birds that are on the side of the road, and we've been responding to those type of calls. We really appreciate the public reporting those so we can check it out. You know, all that's good here moving forward, but no positive sign yet.
Mm-hmm. And, well, there are a lot of other raptors in the Decora area, a lot of other bald eagles. That could be one of the explanations, right? Eagles, males fight sometimes?
Yeah, that's a natural part of eagle territorial actions, and this time of year, probably a little bit earlier in the year, we had, you know, migration of eagles through that area, and we had those two big storms, which what happens with eagles and other raptors, they'll kind of hunker down, and then when the weather subsides, that's kind of a travel period, time to eat and get some food, and they're moving around, and that could have been, you know, just kind of what moved eagles through that area. But I think the thing that we talked about in our response and have looked at here is that, you know, right away the day after we were missing our dad, Decora, we had another male that was right in that area. So, you know, that's one thing to consider. And the folks that we talked to basically said, it's something that happens. You know, it's part of the natural progression and life on the nest.
How is life on the nest without Dad Decora? There's distress there. There has been distress.
Yeah, you know, it's really amazing to watch. It's so sad to see him or not see him after so many years of watching all the detailed actions and the eaglets that he's raised. But I guess things, you know, what we're watching is Mom and the three eaglets, D29, 30, and 31. She's doing an unbelievable job taking care of them. She's a very skilled hunter, and she's got that the ponds with the trout there right across the road, and she's been doing an amazing job. Just the other day, she came up into the nest, flew up with one trout in each foot and tail and grasp, and it was a pretty amazing thing to see. So she's doing a really good job. I guess we couldn't be more pleased with how it's going. The eaglets are being fed regularly.
And she can keep that up, sort of a one-parent household there in the nest. She can keep that up?
Yeah. And, you know, one observation kind of, I've been down there for a good chunk of the week here. It seems like time warp here. But this unidentified male that is in the area, kind of a sideline, he's really, in a way, kind of defending the territory. So even though he's not actively participating with bringing food into the nest, and she has not let him, you know, that close, he's gotten close, but it looks like she's becoming a little bit more relaxed with him, although there's calls and things that I think, you know, we could be interpreting as just warning to not get any closer. But we've seen both of them flying up in the air currents. We've seen, you know, her take off with him and come back in. So it looks like kind of a familiarization period here.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, if he's defending that area, he's kind of fulfilling the partial duties of what a mate would be doing, even though it doesn't seem like they're really tightly connected at this time.
And in the final minute we have, John, just remind us, I mean, bald eagles are incredibly loyal to their mates. Dad Decora was with this female how long?
You know, since the filming of American Eagle, probably around late 2007, early 2008, I believe, was a time period where there was a succession there, and the blind in one eye female that was there died after a snowstorm and disappeared. So, you know, this has about been 10 years now since that. So a long time for this pair that raised or brought 31 eaglets through that nest.
Wow. Fingers still crossed, John Howe, on this. People can keep an update and watch that camera on the nest. Is it raptorresource.org?
Yep, raptorresource.org. And this coming Wednesday, we're going to open up Facebook for just kind of a remembrance celebration. You know, folks can can speak about or type about what their memories are of Dad. And, you know, there's that outside chance that something could change that. But, you know, at least for until that happens, we're planning to kind of celebrate all that he's been to the people that have watched and the students that have learned about nature and life and eagles, you know, and all the details of eagles up in the nest.
Okay, we'll keep hoping for Dad Decor to turn up, along with several hundred million online viewers. John Howe, Executive Director of the Raptor Resource Project, again, to view that nest live, raptorresource.org. Thanks, John.
Thanks much, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Fair Housing Act is marking its 50th anniversary this month. It was signed into law by President Lyndon Johnson just days after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot and killed in April of 1968. Here's a little bit of audio from President Johnson. I guess we don't have that audio here. We do have that audio. This is a little bit of LBJ, 1968, signing the Fair Housing Act.
It proclaims that fair housing for all human beings who live in this country is now a part of the American way of life. We all know that the roots of injustice run deep. But violence cannot redress a solitary wrong or remedy a single unfairness. Of course, all America is outraged at the assassination of an outstanding Negro leader who was at that meeting that afternoon in the White House in 1966. And America is also outraged at the looting and the burning that defiles our democracy. And we just must put our shoulders together and put a stop to both. The time is here. Action must be now.
Audio from April of 1968, the signing of the Civil Rights Act, also known as the Fair Housing Act, its official name, as you heard there, just days after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot and killed, also in April of 1968. I'm joined by Vanessa Baker Latimer, housing coordinator for the city of Ames. Vanessa, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Ben.
You led a march, a short program on Monday in Ames to commemorate the anniversary of this act's passage. Why is it important to celebrate it?
Well, it's important to celebrate it because it was a law that needed to be passed so that justice could be brought to millions of Americans, not only here in Ames, Iowa, but all over our country.
Right. And we remember this comes on the heels of earlier in the 60s, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. And when you take us back to this time, it's really amazing. You could have a neighborhood that would have a covenant of sorts, right, that just said no blacks allowed.
This is correct, and only restricted to apartment complexes or just outside of the community, period, and out in the rural areas. The restriction and the redlining just went on for multiple types of discrimination.
Right, and this act made it a federal crime to discriminate in that way. What is left over? I mean, we are celebrating it, but also knowing that there is work undone here. What sorts of, and I know this was shared in your Monday program, you had, some 70 people there, stories of discrimination in housing, right? What's going
yes.
on?
Well, you know, it still goes on. It's maybe not as blatant in some parts of the country as others, but there are still families and children and people of different national origins and religion and sexual orientation that don't have access to fair housing because of those characterizations that they have or people put on them.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a story that can make us sort of bring it home to us? And people would wonder, well, if this is against the law, if this is a federal crime, how do people discriminate in 2018?
Well, they still are using, like families with children. We're still having landlords across the country or lenders trying to say, well, because you have children, there is a risk that, you know, you could disturb people, or maybe we want to put you in a different side of the building, or we just don't have enough units to accommodate you with children, or we don't have a play area. And a lot of our families that we're trying to help access housing are so focused on trying to get housing so they can't, they don't be homeless, or they're trying to feed their families, that, you know, they don't see those things going on. They just say, okay, and they keep looking. And so that's why it's important for us to work with them to say, hey, that's not fair.
Mm-hmm. Vanessa,
that's not good for you.
Vanessa, you are African American. Do you have any personal experience, or in your circle of friends, an experience that you can relate to us of housing discrimination?
Yes. Back in 1988, when I was working, as I continue to work for the city of Ames, I was working on a project where we had displaced some students because we were buying their housing complex. And my job was to go out and find them comparable housing in the community. And I happened to find a unit that was available for one of the customers that we were displacing. And when I talked to the landlord on the phone, I said, hey, I'm looking for a one-bedroom unit, and I see you have one available. Can I come look at it? And they were very agreeable to me coming to look at it. And so right away that same evening, I drove over there to meet the landlord. And as soon as I got out the car and went to shake the landlord's hand, they pulled back from me and said, well, you know, that unit's no longer available. And I'm like, really? I just talked to you on the phone about it. Well, I'm sorry, it's no longer available. And, you know, I was like, wow, that was quick. And they was walking away from me. And I said, well, can I see it anyway? Just to, no, you wouldn't want to look at it. It's nothing that you would want. And I'm like, wow, it just felt so personal that he was like, just that completely turned away from me. So I went back to the office and I called one of my white coworkers and I said, hey, I just think something's not right here. Would you call this landlord and see if this apartment is available and if he would rent it to you? So she said, sure. So she called and he said, yes, come on over. And as soon as he met her in the parking lot, he showed her the unit and he was ready to rent it to her.
Amazing. Quickly, we don't have long. How do people file a complaint if they think they might have some discrimination?
Well, you can go to HUD's website, and there is a complaint button if you feel you've been discriminated against. And also in Iowa, you can contact the Iowa Civil Rights Commission, and they have a complaint form right on their website as well, and Ames Human Relations Commission, and they can call me right here at the City of Ames, and I certainly will help them walk through the process.
Vanessa Baker-Latimer, Housing Coordinator for the City of Ames. Say, thank you for helping us remember the signing of the Fair Housing Act 50 years ago. Thanks, Vanessa.
Thank you.
It's a Goodbye. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Fred Hubble is a longtime prominent businessman in Des Moines. Now he's running for the Democratic nomination for governor. He says his decision to run came at the end of the 2017 legislative session when Republicans, who had taken control of both chambers for the first time since the late 90s, had rolled back collective bargaining rights for public sector workers and taken funding away from Planned Parenthood. IPR's Clay Masters sat down with Fred Hubble yesterday in IPR's Des Moines studio for our ongoing series of conversations with candidates for governor ahead of the June 5th primary. He started the conversation by asking how Hubble would fix Medicaid, since many say the old model, commonly referred to as fee-for-service, couldn't control costs.
Well, first of all, we have to admit that what Branstad and Reynolds have now done is a failure. Now, what I would do is bring it back under state management, get rid of these managed care companies. All they're doing is focusing on their profit margin and trying to manage their responsibility to their shareholders. They don't have a particular vested interest in Iowans. I want people making these decisions who do have that vested interest. Now, that doesn't mean it has to be a fee-for-service model. There are a lot of other models that are working much better than this state. And let's look at those. And we've got time between now and January 1, when I'm going to, as governor, change this and bring in a place, an approach that's not fee-for-service, not management care, but it's going to put Iowans in charge of making these decisions to make sure Iowans have access to quality, affordable health care.
Sticking with health care issues, there was bipartisan support for a mental health bill that got signed into law. Do you think it does enough? Do you think there's enough teeth in that bill? Or
well, you know, I told you earlier, I've been traveling all across Iowa. I've been in all 99 counties, restaurants, coffee shops, homes. And everywhere we go, mental health and substance abuse comes up. Everywhere, without exception. This bill has a lot of nice language in it, but unfortunately, it's just like a lot of what this governor and this legislature do. They say things that sound good, then you look at the funding, and there's no money. Nothing gets done unless you put the budget behind your priorities. If mental health and substance abuse was truly a priority of Governor Reynolds and the Republican legislature, they would have allocated money in that bill to fund it.
Bringing up the state budget, this is something that the Revenue Estimating Conference regularly was coming back with projections that were less than they had been before. How do you get a hold of what's going on with the budget? I mean, right now, a lot of the concentration at the State House has to do with cutting taxes. How do you make sure that the funding levels are there to sustain mental health programs, public education? How do you get it in control when we look at the current state of Iowa's economy?
Well, I mentioned earlier the fiscal mismanagement of this governor and the misguided priorities. And just let me give you an example. When I was at Economic Development, I was asked by the governor to sit on a tax credit review panel. We looked at every corporate individual tax credit, tax exemption, tax deduction, all of them. And we have a lot of them in Iowa, much more than most other states. And we did an analysis based upon a fiscal impact analysis of each one of those. So if the state was giving away a dollar in a credit or a deduction, what was the state getting back? Were we getting back 50 cents or $1.50? And those that were giving back less than a dollar, we said they should be reduced or eliminated. Why should we continue giving away a dollar and getting back 50 cents? And some were producing more than a dollar, so you want to encourage and support those. We also said we should have caps on all these so they don't just keep growing automatically, and they should have sunset provisions. So the legislature has to actually look at them and determine, do we want to continue these or not? None of that has ever taken place. Those were valued and assessed at the time in 2010. If they've been implemented, all those recommendations, the state of Iowa could save on an annual basis $160 million a year. So that's one of the first things I want to do as governor. I want to put caps in place. I want to put sunset provisions on all these credits, exemptions, deductions, and I want to apply an updated analysis of that fiscal impact. And we're going to find a lot of money that instead of giving away every year and not getting value for Iowans, we should be putting that in education, job training, and in healthcare and infrastructure across our state. Because that's how you grow the economy, not by giving away wasteful corporate tax credits. So that's the first thing we need to do in the tax area. The second thing I think we need to do is look, we had a $900 million surplus in 2013. That's gone. And now the governor owes $144 million. This is a debt to the reserve funds. It needs to be paid back. It was supposed to be paid back this year. They've paid back none of it. And they don't have a plan yet that they've announced to pay it back in the future. So that needs to be paid back because we're looking at serious needs for rainy day reserve funds with all the tariffs that are out there. Already affected our livestock producers, $400 million in value, maybe more tariffs, renewable fuel standards. I mean, we may wake up 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and we're going to have serious challenges to our economy. We're going to need all the reserve funds we get. So that needs to be paid back before anything happens. And I don't understand. You're right about the Revenue Estimating Conference. Every time they come up with an estimate, it changes. Every time they come up with an estimate on the federal deductibility and the impact of the federal tax law changes, that number changes too. So I don't see how we don't know what the managed care organizations are going to cost us to be able to renegotiate those contracts. How can we be talking about tax reductions now when we haven't paid back the debt? We don't know what the MCOs are going to cost. We're looking at tariffs and renewable fuel standards. We're not funding education and health care. We're giving away $160 million a year we shouldn't be giving away. Those things should be known and addressed before we talk about further tax cuts. I agree. We have a complicated, convoluted tax system that doesn't work fairly for all people in Iowa. It needs to be addressed, but it needs to be addressed in a way where we are fiscally responsible, not taking too much risk, which I think is what the legislature is doing today.
It's Fred Hubbell, one of six Democrats vying to face Republican Governor Kim Reynolds in November. Part of our series of conversations with candidates for governor ahead of the June 5th primary. And This and other interviews are put on our website for you to listen to or pass on to others, iowapublicradio.org. Just enough time left in our hour to groove into the weekend with Mark Simmet, Studio One Tracks host. Studio One Tracks, heard daily on Iowa Public Radio, News Studio One at 7 p.m. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Ben. How you doing?
I'm doing good. We really need to have something to groove into the weekend here. It's been another heavy week. What do you got for us?
Is there ever a not heavy week?
Not lately. It's been going this way for well over a year, but let's get to the music because
okay.
I want to groove.
Okay. Dr. Dog is a band from Philadelphia, and they have a new album out called Critical Equation. And the first track on it, when I heard it, everybody's thinking about springtime, and it just hit me that here's a band talking about how this time of the year, suddenly you become aware of different sounds, more sounds outside, especially the animals as they wake up, the birds and so on. That'll make sense when you hear the song. It's called Listening In, and it's from Dr. Dog.
Thanks, Mark Simmet of Iowa Public Radio Studio One. Again, Studio One Tracks, heard daily at 7 p.m. on IPR. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Help today from Natalia Reyes. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.